Okay, so we are recording. It is Monday, 10:20 on June 29th, and we're picking it up with Chem 3 lecture. And today, we got a couple of announcements. Let's see, first, do you know when the sources for the dimensional analysis quiz will get updated? Oh, yeah, hopefully this afternoon. That's my first job to do this afternoon. I didn't do that this weekend. This weekend was my wife's birthday weekend, and I had all kinds of things that we were doing this weekend. But I also managed last night to get the exam up. So of the things to announce, number one, I'll try to update the quiz. Notability's frozen on me. No, it's my pin that's disconnected. See if I can get my pin to reconnect. There it goes. So first announcement is, for all those people asking, there is an error in the dimensional analysis quiz, an error in the key. And so I've got to go back in and I've got to hand correct and give points back to everybody on that, for everybody who got it right and the answer key marked it wrong. So sometimes I go through and I test these darn things, or at least I think I test them. But like anything, when you're trying to program and do it all in Canvas, and it just sometimes gets a little bit complicated and gets away from you. So fortunately, I went through and I tested the exam that I put up, and I found two errors in the exam and corrected those. And I think everything else is good in the exam. So I will go through and I'll be looking at that dimensional analysis quiz tonight. And then I'll update all those scores. And I'll send out an email after I update them so that you know that they've been updated. The next thing is exam one is live. And what I would like you to do with exam one is that while you are taking exam one, I would like you to work on paper and try to keep your work neat. At the end of the exam, much the same way that I did with the dimensional analysis quiz, I'm going to have you upload anything that you want me to look at for partial credit. So if you don't upload anything, it's going to be difficult for me to assess partial credit. However, if you upload your file as a PDF in the same way that we did with the dimensional analysis quiz, then I can go back and look at your handwritten notes and the problems that you did, and I can assess partial credit. If we still have the attempts left for the quiz, can we still use them for a higher score? Yes, Alex, if you still have an attempt left on the quiz, just be careful on the first problem. You may have it right, and I think it's the last roadmap piece that I have an error on the last one of the roadmap. And so if you're getting everything right on the roadmap except for that last one, then it's probably right, and it's my error on that. Okay, so exam one is live. Just like the other quiz, you have two attempts. And I have it programmed to show the incorrect answers. It will not, however, show the correct answer at the end as the quizzes have done in the past. So the quizzes, when you completed, would show you the correct answer after you finished your two attempts. The exam is not going to show the correct answers after the two attempts, just because of the asynchronous nature and how many people are taking the exams and stuff. I didn't want to have it throw out the actual correct answers. But you get two attempts to go through and do the exam. And I think I set a due date of Tuesday night. But like the other due dates for the quizzes, and I think it defaults to like 12 p.m. or 12 a.m. as it ticks over. It's a.m., not p.m. Like the quizzes where I kept them open-ended and I did not have them close out, I will not have the exam close out. However, try and get it done sooner rather than later, rather than leaving that to wait. So that is something that I would like you to put some focus on and try to get that exam done. That way I can go through it this weekend on Friday, once we start into our weekend, and I can go through and assess partial credit for everybody and get that thing graded so that you know where you stand. Is it due tomorrow? It's due tomorrow night by midnight. But again, as I said, it's a flexible due date. I put a due date on it that says Tuesday at 12 a.m., but it won't expire. The exam will still be available in Canvas and you can still complete it. The Canvas, the exam due date says June 29th at 11. I think that's when it starts, not when it was due. It's supposed to be Tuesday night at 11:59. I'll take a look at it. If I need to adjust the due date, I will. But it's an open-ended due date. I mean, it's live now. Go do it. Don't worry about when the due date is. Just finish it as soon as you can. There we go. Three memorized conversion factors. Those are the three keys. So the three memorized conversion factors, I give them the fond name of the three keys. The three key conversion factors, one for length, that's 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. It is one for volume. The volume one is 1 gallon is equal to 3.785 liters. And one for mass, which is 1 pound, equals 453.6 grams. Those are your three key conversion factors that I would like you to memorize. So we haven't had a whole lot of memorization in the class yet. We're about to change that coming up pretty quickly as we start nomenclature and we start talking about how to name ionic compounds. You're going to need to have a working memory of ionic compounds. So we're going to thrust some memorization into the course, but I'm going to teach you a way to memorize them by association and grouping them to knock down the amount of memorization that you need to do. So that's something that we're going to work on. Okay. Today in lab, we are covering electronic configurations to a greater degree in lab. I'm going to do more of it in lecture today. So we're going to look at today in lecture. We're going to try to follow up and look at electronic configuration as much as we need to in order to be able to get into ion formation and ionic compounds. With the goal of really trying to be to get to ionic compounds today and start talking about those ionic compounds so that we can move forward. So we'll leave some of the more tedious parts of electronic configuration we'll leave for lab, and we'll cover that this afternoon in lab as well. And then we'll do a little bit of electronic configuration now as much as we need to be able to start talking about ion formation and then get into ionic compounds. And that way it won't be too redundant between the two things, but we'll still cover enough of what we need for electronic configurations to be satisfactorily sufficient in that. Okay, so that's the plan for today. So let's go ahead and let's start with that and start looking at some of those electronic configurations. And I need to bring in a new page here because I'm going to grab, nope, wrong thing. There we go. I'm going to bring in a periodic table so we have something to work from. Okay, there's our periodic table. And What we said before, as we had started to fill out this periodic table, is that this over here was principal energy level. And so we'll use the variable N for that. And the principal energy levels were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And this is principal energy level 6 and 7 in terms of where they fit into the periodic table there. And we had thrown out that these were the S block, the P block, the D block, and down here, the F block, in terms of these blocks that are here. And we could even highlight these. We could take and highlight this block as the D block, as the S block. Let's get the D and make the D green. And I don't want to obscure the element, so I don't want to shade it, but I want to just capture the block itself. And then the P block, let's go ahead and do that in blue. And actually, hydrogen doesn't really fit within that. I'm going to leave hydrogen out of that for a minute. That's helium. I'm sorry. We're going to leave helium out of that for a minute. And we're not going to worry about the F block so much. So color-wise, this guy's blue. Color-wise, this guy's green. And helium is really part of the S block. But he slides over there because he's a noble gas. So we'll keep him kind of where he is, but note that he's a little bit unique, a little bit different, okay? So we have these different elements, and we can write out their electronic configurations. And we had started doing that. And in fact, for the last class, we had gone through hydrogen and helium. And we had gone through lithium and beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and neon. We had filled out the electronic configurations all the way through neon. And maybe as a reminder, what we can do is quickly fill out the electronic configurations for sodium through argon, just so that we can see how that works. And then we'll use those as a jumping off spot to be able to talk about electronic configurations and ion formation and how things form ions and why they form ions. So let's just do a quick thing here where we will take and we'll look at the 10, is it 10? No, it's 6 plus 2, 8, the 8 elements, starting with sodium and going through argon. So sodium.
Jason, can you go back up for a second just so we can take a picture?
Sure, I'll leave it there. Let me know when you're ready. We good?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right, so sodium, we're going to go through the 1s, the 2s, we'll have the 2ps. I need just a little bit more room there. And then the 3s, and then the 3p. So this is all of the orbitals that we will need. And I'm going to take that pattern and drop that pattern in a few times here in order to get me the 8 elements that I need. So there's 3, 4, and by the magic of copy and paste, slide these guys over just a little bit and see if I can get 4 more of them to fit in. Ah, it is so tight, such a tight screen. Okay, buddy, you're out because you don't fit. We'll go this far for now. Okay, and the elements in order are sodium, and should be magnesium, aluminum, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, and then chlorine. And sodium is element number 11. So I'll track which elements these are: 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And that means that while these are the numbers of protons, for a neutral element, these are also the numbers of electrons. So this is 11 electrons, 12 electrons, 13 electrons, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Okay, so I have my total number of electrons. And as I go and I start filling this table in, I'm going to fill it from the bottom up. And I'm going to use a representation for an electron, which is going to be a half arrow as opposed to a whole arrow. So whereas we would normally do a whole arrow like this, I'm going to do a half arrow. Just because they're a little bit faster to write. It's a little bit easier. So there's 4 electrons, 5, 6, 7, spreading them out, not pairing them unless I have to, 8, 9, 10, and the 11th electron goes into the 3s. And when I write that electronic configuration, that electronic configuration is written as 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s1. And that is sodium's electronic configuration written out. So the things that we call these is, these are electronic configuration diagrams. So we refer to each one of these as an electronic diagram, which shows the energy levels in increasing energy. The farther up, the higher they are, the higher in energy the electrons are. And then this down here is called the electronic configuration. And then we also have a shorthand notation for this electronic configuration, because you can see as I start to get out here to bigger and bigger elements, this list of each of the electrons in each of the principal energy levels and sublevels is going to get much larger. And so there's a shorthand notation that we use. This shorthand notation is called a noble gas core. And the way that it works is I take the 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, and the 3s1, and I say that this piece here is the configuration of the noble gas neon. You can only do this with a noble gas. And that's thus the noble gas core. So we take and we write that as the noble gas neon in square brackets. And that signifies everything that neon has. And then we include the electrons that neon doesn't have, the 3s1. And so that becomes the shorthand electronic configuration for sodium is neon 3s1. So now that we have a shorthand notation, we can use that shorthand notation to sort of denote the rest of these elements as we go forward. And each time we add an electron, we get all of the electrons that we had previously. Plus the new electron, which would be the 12th electron. And that means that magnesium is going to be the neon noble gas core 3s2 for the two electrons which are sitting in the 3s orbital. So that's magnesium's electronic configuration. Then when we go to aluminum, notice that when we go from magnesium here to aluminum, we go through that break in the periodic table. That break signifies the distance in energy from the S to the P orbitals, and then I am going up in energy to a new block because the S block is now filled with magnesium and that second electron coming into the S orbital. So this literally is a 3S1 and a 3S2, and I will start back over here at 3P1. So we can include the 3 there for those elements, but that's where that last electron is going. So now for aluminum, 13 electrons, I have all of the electrons that magnesium had. The 3 S's are filled, and the last electron needs to go into a 3P in order to fill that out. So the electronic configuration for aluminum would be neon, 3S2, 3P1. And that is aluminum's electronic configuration. Silicon is going to have everything that aluminum had plus one more. So the table fills out quickly. And we separate the electrons in the degenerate energy levels. Degenerate energy levels means energy levels that are equivalent, that are the same. So anytime we have orbitals that are on a line like this, those orbitals are all the same, and they're of the same energy. And because electrons repel one another, because they are like charges, we move them into separate orbitals until such time as all the orbitals are half filled, and then we go back and we start filling the orbitals. It doesn't make any difference in the way I write the electronic configuration. It still is written in exactly the same way, 3s2, 3p2. So I don't see that, the fact that they need to be separated and unpaired. But when I write it out in an energy diagram, it is important that that energy diagram have the two orbitals, the two electrons separate in their own orbital. The same is true for phosphorus. Phosphorus is going to have 3 unpaired electrons. So there's phosphorus is 3 unpaired, and this is neon, 3s2, 3p3. And likewise, sulfur, these can be predicted so that I know that I'm adding one electron each time. I could write the electronic configuration for sulfur without even drawing the energy diagram. It is a 3s2, 3p4. And for the chlorine, neon, 3s2, 3p5. And the electrons filling them in for sulfur now, all the orbitals are half filled. I have to go back and I have to fill one. So when I fill one, I make sure that it goes spin down and that it's paired up. And chlorine, would have that electronic configuration. Then when I go to argon, the last one would fill out the 3P energy level. And so literally, as I'm looking at these, they are in families where all of these are P1s. All of these are P2s, P3s, P4s, P5s, and P6, where the sublevel is entirely filled. And it just makes a difference as to which energy level I'm filling. Like these are the 3p2s. This one is 3p3 for that last electron. Nitrogen above it is principal energy level 2. This would be 2p3. In the same way that this would be 2s2 and 2s1 for its last electron. So I can tell exactly what the electronic configuration of any element is simply by looking at its location in the periodic table. Apologize, I realize that my camera is turned off. You guys are just watching my feed there, but sometimes it's nice to be able to see my face and my presentation as well. I like to keep that camera running. Okay. Let's spend a second talking about these sublevels. We said that these sublevels, let's do a closer look at the sublevels. When we look at the energy diagrams, this was the 1S, the 2S, the 2P, the 3S. We could look at the 3P above that. We see that there are differences in the principal energy level, and yet these sublevels, the S, the P, these guys are the sublevels. And the sublevels, these were the L principal energy level, azimuthal value that was the quantum number L, whereas the principal energy level, the 1 or the 2 or the 3, that was the level. The sublevels are broken down into individual orbitals, and the lines we think of as the orbitals themselves. So these guys, the lines themselves, represent the orbitals. And the sublevels get listed as S, P, D, F, and then alphabetical from there. The orbitals also have names to them. Those orbital names are spatial orientations. For instance, within the P's, if we look at the two P's, the two P's are constituted, 2P equals an orbital which is a PXY, a P that is, think about where they're located. Oh no, I have the, that's not an XY. It's a PX, a PY, and a PZ. And that is denoting the orientation on an XYZ coordinate system of the orientation of the P orbital. So these orbitals and the sublevels in particular have geometries to them, have shapes to them, and they are standing waves. So what we can say is that the sublevels, and to an extent, the orbitals themselves are standing waves. And as a standing wave, they have a specific geometry. And really, these orbitals, when we say an orbital, we're talking about the mths of L, the orbitals that correspond to the mths of L quantum number. The sublevel, the S, P, D, so on, which is the L value within that, can be thought of as sort of a geometry class. For instance, S's, when I look at S's are spherical. And it's not that S stands for spherical, but they just happen to be sharp and spherical, both start with S. That spherical in shape means that when I look at an S orbital, the S orbital has this sort of spherical geometry to it and looks like a ball. And that if you could look at the probability, if you could stop the electron and slow the electron down, there you go, Roxanne. If I could slow the electron down and I could take a picture of the electron, what I would find is that if this were the nucleus, let me do the nucleus in red. So there's the nucleus. We'll do the electron in blue. That a lot of the time I find the electron around the nucleus. And so each little photograph that I'm taking, I'm finding the electron in a specific location. But as I slow that process, or as I extend out, what I find is that the electron, I find it less and less the farther away from the nucleus I go. And that makes a sphere that is really dense in its center, but less dense as I move out. You can imagine or picture grains of sand trapped in glass with a lot of grains of sand very near the nucleus and fewer grains of sand as you move away from the nucleus. And that is captured in a graph that has probability of finding the electron. So this is probability. And this is distance from the nucleus. And what I see is that probability goes from zero on up to a maximum at a certain distance, and then tapers off the farther away I get from the nucleus. And that results in a spherical geometry. This is S, the 1S. As I go to the 2S, let's remember and correlate this with the idea that, remember that I had the fixed rope at two ends, and I said that in the first sort of energy for that rope, that rope could go back and forth, jumping like a jump rope, it could swing around. And hang on, Eric, and I'll hit that sand explanation again as I go through the next example. I'll cover that sand explanation again. In the second, so this was like the zero order, and then when I go to the first order, remember we said that there was a node that the jump rope could assume this sort of pattern where the rope can now swing this way and this way, but never moves from that center node. And the node is an area where there is no activity, where the rope doesn't move. This standing wave, this three-dimensional spherical object at a 2S gets bigger. And so the difference between a 1S and a 2S is the size of the orbital. The size of the orbital increases as I go to a 2S. And yet inside the 2S, there is an area where there is no orbital density. That area where there is no orbital density is the node. And so I have the nucleus, which sits in the middle. And so we can go back to the sand example that Eric was asking me to explain again. And in the sand example, I have an area of high concentration of where I find the electron, a probability, a very high probability of finding the electron in the center here. And then as I move out, and I move out from the center, it decreases to a degree, and then I go through a node, and then I get an area of high concentration again, and lots of electron density sitting around here, until I taper off again as I get farther out away. And this picture, when I look at it with an energy diagram, shows an area of high concentration comes down to nothing, and then another area of concentration before it tapers off. And this is the node in that standing wave that is like a balloon within a balloon, in a sense. And so our probability and our distance from the nucleus. And the different, go ahead, question.
I have a question about that first graph. So that graph is representing the probability of finding an electron?
That's right.
But is the graph, is the beginning of the graph representing the nucleus?
It is. So when we think about the distance here, we are at zero distance from the nucleus, and the probability of finding the electron at the nucleus is zero, because the electron can't exist within the nucleus.
But why doesn't it go sharply up, because there's so many electrons around the nucleus?
There aren't so many. We're only dealing with the probability of finding a single electron around the nucleus that exists within this standing wave. So here's the thing about an electron. So this is the hard part. We think about the electron as a particle. We have talked about the electron as having a mass. And because the electron has a mass, which is about 1/2000th of an AMU, 1/2000th the amount of a proton or a neutron, because it has a mass, we think of it as a particle. However, the electron is not a particle. The electron is a wave. The electron has what is called a probability density map of where we might find it. Based on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, we cannot know both the location and the speed of an object simultaneously. And so when we want to talk about the location of an electron, we can no longer talk about its speed. And when we talk about its location, we can talk about it as a particle. However, when we want to talk about it as having energy and as a standing wave, then we lose the particle nature. And these maps that I'm drawing become what are called probability density maps. The probability density maps are standing waves, and the standing waves tell us where we are likely to find the electron at any given point in time. And these waves take on different geometries based on the different type of orbital that it is, whether it is an S, a P, a D, or an F. And they have different geometries. Okay, so there's not actually more electrons. No, the dots are sort of like a flashbulb picture where you're trying to like stop motion, and they're representing different pictures in time and the probability of where I will find an electron at any certain point in time. Not like rings on a tree exactly either. It's very different than that. And the electrons aren't even in constant motion. It's really that they exist at all of these places simultaneously to different degrees or different probability. That's a hard concept to understand. Try to imagine that. So imagine how you might take a bicycle that's got a tire with a whole lot of spokes. And when you spin the tire fast enough, all the spokes kind of blur and you can't see an individual spoke. But if you put your finger into the tire while it's spinning, you're definitely going to get hit by one of those spokes. All right, so there's a whole lot of spokes, but let's take it to a single electron. Take a bicycle tire that is connected by one wire, and it would be a very fragile bicycle tire. But imagine if you could, a bicycle tire connected by one wire. Spin it as fast as you can. That wire is now spinning so fast that it blurs and you can't see anything. But if you stick your finger in there, no matter how fast you stick your finger in, you're going to get tagged, because that spoke is sort of existing simultaneously at all points in space and starting to become more wave-like than it is particle-like. That's kind of what we're talking about here. That's a sort of the best analogy that we can kind of give to it in order to explain how that electron actually exists. And I don't know if I can do it on this. Nope, I can't. So let me try to do something else. Let me stop broadcasting here. And let me start broadcasting or share screen up here. Basic. And I'm going to share my desktop and see what's actually coming up. So can you guys see my desktop at this point? No, you're seeing just the zoom view, and that's not what I want. So what I need is one more time, share screen. And it doesn't give me the ability. Okay. They've changed it for some reason. It's not the entire desktop as the way it used to be. It's only one application. So let me go start my application and then I will just share that application. Applications. And this application is called Atom in a Box. I think. Oh no. They killed it. Let me see. This might be a good time to take a break since we're almost there anyway, and then I can figure out if I'm going to be able to show you guys this or not. I've got it on my iPad. Okay. I've got it on my phone. I'm going to get it on my iPad real quickly. Let's see if I can get it. Atom in a Box. Ooh, and it's in HD. No kidding. And I have to pay for that. That's not cool. But I want it. Okay. And open. Oh, and it's got sound. Trippy. Okay. This, I can't even turn down the sound. Oh, because it's not on my computer. Hang on a second, we'll get there. Nope, I can't even turn down the sound much. Okay, stop, just stop rotating. There must be a way to kill sound. Quality, camera brightness, orientation, sound. Whew. Oh, so much better. I apologize. Okay. So what I want to show you with this is, first, I'm going to go to an S orbital. And you can see that these are the quantum numbers that I am toying with at the bottom of the screen. And I know it's rotated. Unfortunately, it's not viewing exactly the way I want it to view and flipping for you guys. It's in the wrong mode, but you can see the quantum numbers up at the top, sort of left-hand side, and this is a spherical orbital, and what I can do is, with this spherical orbital, I think, usually you can represent it and show the energy diagram along with it. Oh, there it goes. Oh, everything just pops out all of a sudden. That's really cool. So what we can see here is a very complicated mathematical equation. The graph, which is what I was trying to draw, which is a probability of finding the electron as a function of the radius. So there's the probability, which is super cool. And this denotes an orbital, which is spherical. If I go up to a 2s, I can go to a 2s, and all of a sudden you see the probability density change, and you can see the node in the center of it. Are you guys seeing this? No, you're not seeing this at all, are you?
Yeah, we're.
Oh, you are? Okay, cool. All right, I was afraid that I wasn't broadcasting there and I was just not making any sense whatsoever. What do you think is going to happen when I go to a 3S?
Two nodes.
Two nodes, exactly. And so when I go to a 3S and I click this up one more, now you can see the two nodes, which is beautiful. And Eric, yeah, it's turned 90 degrees and I would like to turn it, but I can't. The iPad is turned, but the app is not turning with me. I'm locked in. That's all it's given me. So unfortunately, that's what we get. But that's okay because we're in a three-dimensional space and what I get is the rotation of it. If I go up to a 4, now this is a 4S, the 4S would have three different nodes in it. And notice that the size of the orbital continues to change. Okay, let's go back down to the 1s. All right, within 1s, if I go to principal energy level 2, I can access the 2p's. The 2p's, this one is harder to understand what it is we're actually seeing. This is the two dumbbells. This is a picture, and I'll draw it for you in a different way, but this is a picture that represents essentially a dumbbell and has two lobes and a node in the middle. This is the 2s, and I can swing it around and I can let it sort of rotate in three-dimensional space. Normally, they give me an XYZ coordinate system, which is really nice. I don't know if they'll give me an XYZ coordinate with this. They don't. So this is what I get. And along with this XYZ, what I can do is I can go from a 2P up to a 3P. Notice that it introduces a new node, still sort of this dumbbell shaped, but gets more complicated with another node in it. So this is a 3P. Go up to a 4P, I get additional nodes. From the P's, I can take and I can look at the D's. The D's have a cloverleaf pattern. And I'll draw that pattern for you. Actually, it's this pattern. It is the cloverleaf one. I'll have to sort of draw it for you. So let me go back and let me draw just these images real quick. And then we'll take a break. So let me go back to here. And so what we looked at now is we looked at the two S's, which were spherical, the one S, which was spherical. When I look at a P has a shape that is like two balloons connected together with a node in the middle. And the first time that I have P's are the two P's. When I go to a 3P, the orbital gets bigger, but it has two nodes in it, and it's like two balloons connected together. And when I have the redundant orbitals, let's say that this is the 2P down here. I have one that is oriented on the X-axis, one that is oriented on the Y-axis, and one that is oriented on the Z-axis. So what I see when I look at these orbitals is that on the x-axis, I have a lobe that extends out this way and this way. On py, this being the y-axis, I have a lobe that extends out here and back that way. And on the pz, this one being the z-axis, I have one that extends that way and that way. And those are my three degenerate orbitals that are the 2p orbitals, each one occupying a very similar shape, but in a different orientation so that they don't overlap in space. When I go to the 3Ps, the same thing happens. I'm only going to draw one of them. But in the 3Ps, what I have is I have the larger orbital and the smaller one inside that has the node. And that would be the 3PX orbital that I would be looking at. I would also have a similar 3PY and 3PZ. When we look at the D orbitals, the D orbitals have a picture that is four balloons tied together. And these four balloons have different orientations in which they can go in. And they have two nodes. So notice that as I'm going up in orbitals, I go from an S that has no nodes in 1s to a P that has one node in the 2p and to a D that has two nodes in the 3d. And so these D orbitals will have a series of clover leaves, like four balloons connected together that will be in different orientations in space. And there are four of them that have those four different orientations. And then there is a fifth one. So there are this times four and a fifth one that has a unique pattern that has sort of this ring that goes around a dumbbell. And the ring around the dumbbell is the fifth D orbital. As we go from D's into F's, the F's have even more interesting pictures, but we tend not to go into the Fs and look at the Fs. But the idea here is that they exist as standing waves, and that those standing waves have geometries, and that they exist and pack into the atom in these particular sorts of geometries, and that the bigger the orbital is, the farther away from the nucleus, and the more energy the electron has that resides in that orbital. So that's a whole lot. What do I want you to get out of that? We don't really use the orbitals until we get into organic chemistry. Maybe we use them a little bit within Chem 1B, not so much in Chem 1A, but they go over them and we continue to go over them because they're so fundamental and they're so important to the geometry of molecules that we form later on, that understanding these atomic orbitals is really important. So that's where we get to. Let's maybe take a break now, and we'll come back and we'll show how we can use these electronic configurations to start talking about geometries. And Elias, the exam is not on stuff from today. That is correct. I truncated the exam to chapters 1 and 2, and we are in chapter 3 right now. So we're at the tail end of chapter 3, and this is not on the exam, and that is correct. All right, let's take a break. It's 11:15. Let's come back at 11:25, and we'll pick it up and we'll do some more from there. All right?
Do you remember when we first met? I sure do. It was sometime in September 93. Well, you were lazy about it. You made me wait around. I was so crazy about you, I didn't mind. Well, I was late for class. I locked my bike to yours. It wasn't hard to find, 'cause you painted flowers on. I guess that I was afraid that if you rode away, you might not roll back my direction anytime soon. I was crazy about you then, and now but the craziest thing of all, over 10 years have gone by, you're still mine, locked in time. Now let's rewind. Piano took up the living room. You play me boogie woogie, I play you love song. You'd say we're playing house, now you still say we are. We built our getaway up in a tree we found. We fell so far away, but we were still in time. Now I remember watching that old tree burn down. I took a picture that I don't like to look. Well, all these times they come and go, and alone they don't seem so long. Over 10 years have gone by, we're locked in time, you're still mine. Now let's rewind. Oh, remember the mockingbirds, my baby. Sing for the supper, baby. Yes, they used to sing for the dinner, girl. They used to sing so sweet. Since my baby left me, ain't sing a tune all day, all day. Well, come on, pretty baby, come on back to me now. Make everybody as happy as can. Come on, Zach. Come on.
than a girl. Yes, you know I kiss you for a supper, babe. But if you don't come home to me, well, I have to start the day. Ain't had a kiss all day now.
Keep giving me hope for a better day. Keep giving me love to find a way through this heaviness. I feel I just need someone to say everything's okay. Woke my weary head, crawled out of my bed, and I said, how do I go on? Nothing's going right. Shadows took the light, and I said, oh, how do I go on? Sometimes I need a little sunshine.
come on and take me by the hand, lead me through the troubled waters of the sea. So maybe, yeah, you got a halo over your head all the time. Well, as for me, all I need is this rhythm for moving, 'cause you know I keep kicking it live, yeah. Well, can I get a witness to defend my case? No, I won't get caught up in the corporate rat race. Well, all I got is commitment, and behind it I'll stand tall. If that shadows get me down, I'ma roll if I fall. So step back for a moment to analyze all that you've achieved. Tell me, was it what you wanted? Did it make you happy? Or had you been deceived? And if you still have yet to understand this theme, well, plain and simple, don't live somebody else's dream, yeah. But you know the sea will surely come again, and the stars fill the sky. Well, it's a simple inspiration, but it always blows in my mind, yeah. Well, can I get a witness to present my plea? And no, I won't fall victim to this animosity. Well, all they can teach you is the writing on the wall. I'm gonna cut my strings free, and I'ma roll if I fall. You know I'll roll if I fall. That always gets me high. It's a familiar disposition, like I can see it in your eyes. It's the beauty of a new sunrise. You could never see one the same. And when we add the score at the end of this life, wanna say I won the game. It's a simple inspiration that always gets me by. It's a familiar disposition, I swear I see it in your eyes. Well, it's the beauty of a new sunrise. You could never see one the same. And when we add the score at the end of this life, wanna say I won the game. Whoa, 'cause it's a simple inspiration that always gets me high. It's a familiar disposition, that's where I see it in your eyes. It's the beauty of a new sunrise, you could never see one the same. And what we had to score at the end of this life, I wanna say I won the game. I wanna say I won the game. I wanna say I won the game. Oh, oh, oh. I wanna say I won the game, yeah. I bring it back in.
See, I'll stop sharing there, start back over on the iPad. We'll pick it up where we left off. Okay, so we were covering these shapes, we're covering these geometries. And our job now that we've covered the geometries a little bit and we understand sort of what these things are, is to set up some other definitions that we haven't covered yet. We started to in lab, but let me take the electronic configuration of a particular element and let me choose, let's see, where's my periodic table? There we go. Let me choose sodium. Let's look at sodium. Sodium, which we did its electronic configuration just a little bit ago, it has an electronic configuration having 11 protons and therefore 11 electrons. There's its 1s, its 2s, its 2p, and the 3s electron. That's all I need in order to figure out this electronic configuration. So I'm putting in 11 electrons. And that takes me up to 3s1. So this is a 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s1 for sodium. And there is a definition of what we call valence and core electrons. The valence electrons are defined as the highest principal energy level electrons. And the core electrons are everything below the valence. So these are all electrons below the valence electrons. And these are the electrons that are closest to the nucleus. So we think of the core electrons as the electrons that are closest to the nucleus. And the valence electrons are the highest energy electrons. And they're the farthest away, essentially. So when we take and we break out these electrons into core and valence electrons, what we find is that it breaks out this way, that these electrons here our core, and that the electron that is in the highest principal energy these are the valence electrons. So we have the core electrons and we have the valence electrons that we're looking at. And it is the valence electrons that are critically important. The valence electrons are used in chemical reactions. They are sort of the currency of the elements in that they are traded, they are shared, in order to try to achieve a more stable electronic configuration. So valence electrons are traded, meaning lost and gained. They are shared in order to achieve a more stable configuration. All right, let's take a look at the periodic table again. Let me bring this periodic table in so that we can talk about why this may be the case. When we look at the periodic table, one of the things that we said was that these guys on the right-hand side of the periodic table, these are our noble gases. And I'm gonna do the noble gases in green, not blue. Blue seems royal. So these noble gases, they are the nobility of the periodic table. Thus, the reason that we call them noble gases. And these elements tend not to react with other elements. They tend not to form compounds. They tend not to gain or lose electrons. They tend to be very, very stable. In fact, the first noble gas compounds formed from these noble gases were not discovered until the 1950s or 1960s. And one of the first people to do that was a chemist up here at UCSC, Stanley Williamson, who took a flask of noble gas combined with some other elements and put that flask on the rooftop of one of the buildings and left it on the rooftop in the sun for weeks on end, and then took it and analyzed it and actually found that several compounds were made from the high energy, the high solar energy reacting with that vessel, allowed these guys to form some of the first compounds that were ever discovered for these, that these were thought to be almost entirely inert and just really unreactive towards other things. Thus, the wording noble was meant to mean that these were really the nobility of the periodic table. If you think about what noble means or what nobility means in terms of our common vernacular, when we say that somebody is a noble, they're very high class. They have wealth, they have money, they have fame, they have all of those different things that everybody is sort of envious of. This is where I sort of anthropomorphize the periodic table, but for good reason, because it serves a purpose and it helps us to understand why the elements in the periodic table react the way that they do. The stability of these elements comes from the fact that they have a filled out energy level. When we get to the end of the periodic table, it is these elements here that fill out principal energy level 1 for helium, fill out principal energy level 2 for neon, 3 for argon, 4 for krypton. The principal energy levels are entirely filled by these elements. And having a full complement of electrons makes these elements very, very stable. The elements in the periodic table, in contrast to that, do not have filled out energy levels, and as such are not as stable as these elements over here, as the noble gases. And so what the elements on the rest of the table can do is they can gain or lose electrons in a quest to become what's called isoelectronic with the noble gases. Isoelectronic is a word that means similar electronic configuration, or that they will obtain an electronic configuration which is identical essentially to a noble gas, thereby becoming more stable. The ways to achieve that is to gain or lose electrons depending upon where you are in the table. And for those elements that are in the table in certain locations, it's very difficult to gain or lose, and so they share. And so we will see a sharing of electrons as well. So those two ways allow elements to gain configurations, which makes them similar to the noble gases and therefore more stable. It's what drives almost all chemical reactivity. It can be taken back to this idea of a noble gas configuration. So as we start to look at this idea, it is the valence electrons, the electrons on the outermost of the elements, which are gained or lost or shared. And so as we start this and we start to look at sodium, one of the things that sodium can do, if we take a look at sodium's electronic configuration, so we're here at sodium, and we have a 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s1. So this is sodium's electronic configuration. And we can even put it into an energy diagram if we want to. And that last electron, that valence electron, sits right there. Nope, I need one more. That's, something's amiss. I'll fix it. I know what's wrong. What's wrong is I didn't label everything the way that I should have. This was 1s, this was 2s, next comes 2p, and then 3s, and there's the 3s1. And remember that the closest noble gas to sodium was neon, and that this represented the neon core. And so this could be written neon 3s1, where the 3s1 is the valence electrons and everything else in that is core. And so what we have is we have a neon, can I move it up? No, I'm going to keep it right there. What we have is we have a neon atom. Nope. What am I? I'm on a sodium atom. What we have is a sodium atom. This sodium atom has 11 protons, 11 positive charges, and 11 electrons. And what it can do is it can lose an electron so that we can take an electron away. And if we take an electron away, it's still a sodium. It still has 11 protons and thus 11 positive charges. Actually, I don't want to put the P there. Let's just do it. It's 11 positive charges. And now it has 10 electrons. And it has now only 10 negative charges. And so its net is 1+. So we take and we put that plus up there. And now we give it a new name and we call it a sodium ion. And its electronic configuration, if I were to look at its electronic configuration, it would have the sodium with a positive charge. But now it's going to have only the 10 electrons. And it will be a filled out energy level where the 1s, the 2s, and the 2p are filled, and the 3s is empty. And so its electronic configuration, if I were to write it out now, is written out 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s0. There are no electrons in the s. And this is its noble gas core configuration. So this is neon. But to distinguish it from neon, I put the positive charge there. And to distinguish this as sodium, I put it in square brackets and put the positive charge on the outside as I draw the ion. So these are two ways to represent that sodium ion's electronic configuration. Is that iodized salt? Iodized salt does not mean ion. Iodized salt means that there is iodine that has been added to the salt, although sodium ion is a component of salt. So in a sense, yes, but not for the reason that you're thinking of, Eric. Okay. So what we've shown here is that we've shown that sodium, here's another way to represent it, that I can think of sodium as being this element, Na, that has an electronic configuration of 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s1. This is the element. It is neutral. It has equal numbers of protons and neutrons, or protons and electrons. So my positives equal 11. My electrons equal 11. My charge, which is the net charge, equals 0. As it loses an electron, it becomes smaller and it becomes positively charged. And that electron gets kicked out. Its electronic configuration now changes, and the way that I represent it changes so that I can still tell that it is a sodium ion and not a neon that I'm dealing with. I put its electronic configurations in brackets and put the charge on it. If I write it in the noble gas core, I put the brackets around it and put the charge on it. And that charge tells me that it has lost an electron. And now, when I look at the number of protons, the positive charges still equal 11, the electrons, the negative charges now equal 10, and the charge, the net, so this is 10 negatives, 11 positives, the net equals a plus 1. And this thing changes its name to sodium ion. Whereas before, its name was sodium. Okay. This is a cation. A cation is a positively charged ion. We've covered those names before, but now we can see why it's happening. Because on the periodic table, what sodium is doing is sodium is falling back by giving up an electron. It's falling back to the previous noble gas and becoming positively charged in doing so. But in doing so, it's becoming more stable because it has a noble gas core configuration. And that's why it goes through and does that. An anion, something like fluorine, if we look at fluorine, fluorine from the periodic table, if we think about its size and how big this element actually is, it has 9 protons and 9 electrons. So that's 9 positives and 9 negatives. And that means that it's neutral with a net charge equal to 0. Fluorine can gain an electron. And I didn't put its electronic configuration down. It's 1s2, 2s2, 2p5.
Question.
Yes.
You said it can gain an electron.
So yes.
Can. Is that because the most stable noble gas is closest to it by that addition?
That's right. So when we look at where fluorine is in the periodic table, fluorine is here in the periodic table. Its closest noble gas is neon, one electron away. By gaining an electron, it can become isoelectronic with neon.
And sodium was trying to be neon, so it was trying to go back and back.
So it was trying to go back to neon, that's right.
Okay.
So one on the left-hand side of the periodic table is losing electrons, and those things on the right-hand side of the periodic table are going to gain electrons.
Okay. Cool.
It's however they can get closest to the noble gas. So whatever is closest, whether falling backwards or gaining, whichever gets them closest, that's how they're going to react. And the word becomes isoelectronic, and that's right, isoelectronic meaning same electronic configuration.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And so as we look at fluorine here, we pick up an electron, and as we pick up that electron, the element gets bigger because we're adding more electrons to the outside. And it gets a negative charge. So as you add more electrons, the actual size of the ion gets bigger. The symbol we change to represent as an ion. We change this one's name, and it becomes FLUOR, and then we change the ending to IDE. The IDE ending denotes an atomic anion. It still has 9 protons because that's what makes it a fluorine. So the 9 protons has not changed. That means 9 positive charges. But now we've picked up an extra electron, so that means 10 negative charges. And so my net is a 1 minus. That is the 1 minus that is now being represented as the negative charge in the various locations. Its electronic configuration is now 1s2, 2s2, 2p6. And to distinguish it from neon, I must put it in square brackets and put the negative charge on it. and that denotes that it is the anion fluoride that I am talking about. It says that there is one more electron than the total number of protons. And I could also write it neon in brackets with a negative charge on the outside. And that means that it is isoelectronic with the element neon. So are the elements closer to the middle of the table generally more adaptable to more elements than those on the ends, or is the opposite? The ones in the middle of the table are going to do some interesting things. We're going to have to wait until we get to those. I don't think we're going to make it to those today. But what we're going to do is we're going to look at these elements on the periodic table, and I suggest that the next one that we look at is magnesium, and then maybe oxygen. So let's take a look at magnesium for a second. Magnesium, being element 12, has the electronic configuration, and I'm just going to do it by electronic configurations, has the electronic configuration 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2. Its valence electrons are here, and it has two valence electrons.
Is that a 12?
It is.
Why?
Why?
Yes.
What is magnesium's atomic number?
Cool, it's 12. Thank you.
That's where it comes from. So that 12 is the atomic number that is telling me how many numbers of protons it has, and when it's neutral, the same number of electrons.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So that's its electronic configuration. Magnesium can go and can lose two electrons. And in losing two electrons, becomes a magnesium with a 2+ charge on it. As a 2+ charge, because it has lost the two electrons, its electronic configuration is now 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s0, I'll put it in parentheses, and put the 2+ on the outside. It is now the neon core with a 2+, and we call it magnesium ion. Oxygen. Oxygen is element number 8. And as element number 8, it has a 1s2, 2s2, 2p4 electronic configuration. Oxygen can gain 2 electrons to become a 2-. In so doing, it becomes the electronic configuration 1s2, 2s2, 2p6. Now we put it in brackets and put the 2-. This is neon, isoelectronic with neon, with a 2- charge, and we call it oxide. Changing that ending from oxygen to IDE, whereas this one was oxygen, it now picks up oxide. Why did it gain 2 electrons? It gained 2 electrons because when I go back to the periodic table, oxygen is 1, 2 steps away from neon. So by gaining two electrons, it becomes isoelectronic with neon. What we find, what's really interesting, is that remember we have said that these elements exist in families with similar electronic configurations. And so what we find is that these guys here all become -1 ions. These guys all become -2 ions. These guys all become -3 ions because they are 3 steps away from a noble gas. On the other side of the periodic table, these all become +1. These all become +2. And these here all become +3. And these that are in 4, they're halfway in between the positives and the negatives. These tend to share electrons rather than becoming ions for the most part, just because it's easier for them to do so.
Who gets to become an ide?
These guys all become IDEs. The ides are the anions, the molecular anions. So anything that has a negative charge takes on an IDE ending. Nitride, oxide, fluoride, chloride, bromide, iodide, phosphide, selenide. They all become an IDE ending to denote that they are anions. The name does not denote the charge, however. There is no difference between a 3-, a 2-, and a 1- in its name. Its location in the periodic table tells us what its charge becomes, and we know its location, and we can then ascertain its charge just by knowing that it has an IDE ending. The cations, however, get the name just ion at the end, and so it becomes lithium ion, sodium ion, potassium ion, calcium ion. We don't change the ending of the name on a cation. And does it go to +3 on their side? It does. If you look at the +3, it's right here. So we skip over these guys because remember, we're going from the S block to the P block. So as we go from S to P, this is the group that's over here. Oh, and look at these numbers here. Let me look at this real quick and show you. 1A, 2A, 3A, 5A, 6A, 7A, 4A, and 8A was up here. These A values equals the number of valence electrons for that element. Or I should say for all elements in that row or that family, group and family. That's the name that I want to use. So we'll say it that way for all elements. In the group or family. I think that's what I wanted to put in parentheses, not really this. That's better. Okay, so the A values represent the number of valence electrons that an element has and makes it very easy for us to be able to tell how many valence electrons an element has just by looking at the periodic table and knowing what group it happens to be in. So everything that is in group 1A has one valence electron. Everything in group 2A has two valence electrons. Everything in 3A, 3 valence. 4 valence, 5 valence, 6 valence, 7 valence, and finally out to 8 valence electrons.
Quick question.
Yeah.
What if sodium had like 2 less electrons? Would we write it in the same way that we write magnesium?
In general, it is very, very challenging for sodium to lose 2 electrons as opposed to losing just 1, because sodium, being in its position where it is, has to lose 1 electron to become, isoelectronic with neon. But if it lost 2, it would become isoelectronic with fluorine, which really, really wants to gain that electron. And so we tend not to have it lose 2 in that way.
Okay.
In fact, I don't think I've ever seen that. It's not that we couldn't artificially create it. I'm sure that we could strip it of that second electron, but it would be extremely reactive and it would not last very long. So it's not something that we tend to do. But in regards to your question, you said, would we write it in the same way that we write something else? Neon with the positive charge. I think the answer to that is that we couldn't write it in the same way. We'd have to change the representation. We'd have to change the representation so that we wouldn't use the noble gas core. We would just write it with its standard electronic configuration, put it in square brackets, and then put the charge in the upper right-hand corner.
Okay. So, for example, if nitrogen would have
just... like a 1-?
Yeah. Would we write oxygen and nitrogen the same way?
What we would do, no, because we only use those noble gas cores to represent the noble gas. So we don't take into a core of any element we want. It's called a noble gas core because it's restricted to only using noble gases. So for instance, if nitrogen that has in electronic configuration 1s2, 2s2, 2p3 were to gain just one electron, so we add one electron to it, it would become an N with a minus charge, and it would be 1s2, 2s2, 2p4. We put the parentheses around it, and we put a negative charge. And then there's no noble gas core configuration that I could write because I haven't obtained the noble gas core configuration.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. And we don't want to represent this as oxygen with a negative charge because that's not truly, oxygen is not a noble gas. And so that's kind of cheating. That's not following the rules. All right. So we have this idea of these.
A question that's kind of related to that.
Please go for it.
So it's not about filling the orbitals. It's about getting to the closest noble gas. Like with sodium, you could add a negative electron or subtract a negative electron to fill the orbitals, but it wouldn't bring you closer to a noble gas.
I see your question. Let me, yeah, I see your question. I got it. Let me look at sodium and let's put sodium here in the middle and let's put its orbitals here. And let's reproduce this twice. So the question is, starting from sodium and sodium's electronic configuration, which is the 3s1. So this is the 3s orbital that is here. So it is 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s1. That is its base configuration. One way of thinking about that. When I lose an electron, I fall back to a sodium ion. And having fallen back to that sodium ion, it is now 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, and I put it in brackets and put the positive charge in. And this is what we call a sodium ion. Can I do this? And why doesn't it do this? This would be adding an electron. So plus an electron. This is taking away an electron, subtracting one. To add one, this would become a sodium, I don't even know how I would say that, sodonide. It would be a 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, but it would have a filled 3s. And so you're trying to correlate filling an orbital, which should give it some stability, versus filling it through loss, which would give it stability. This would make it isoelectronic with magnesium. This would make it isoelectronic with neon, the noble gas. Filling out the orbital tends not to be as stable as filling out a shell. So where I have filled a shell, this is the 2p and the 2s, and I have a filled shell or filled level. This still has the 3p's, and the level is not filled. The orbital is filled, but the level is not. Unfilled shell or unfilled level. It's not as stable. It is more stable to fill out the shell than it is to fill out just a sublevel in and of itself. So that's why it doesn't tend to go that way. That's a great question and allows to clarify it for everybody. So thank you for that question. I appreciate that. Yeah, damn carpet cleaners. Sorry, my text messages come through. And even my phone is completely silenced, so nothing comes through on my phone. I silence them on my iPad. They still come through on my iPad. So sometimes you'll see me click off things really quickly, but sometimes I don't, and they're hysterical, and we all get a good laugh. So life goes on, and that's the way it is in COVID. Yeah, just hope they're not texting me anything bad. All right. It's just, I keep wondering about my buddies, my good friends who know that I'm teaching, right? And know that I'm teaching for 8 hours a day. And what are they going to send me just to mess with me? So it just terrifies me sometimes to think about what they could send me. I don't know. All right. It's a good thing I have good friends rather than crap friends that would really want to mess with you. Okay. What do I got to do from here? What I got to do from here is we have introduced ions. And we have introduced why they form ions. And so now I could ask you a question. I could ask you questions using the periodic table, and I could say, what type of ion does phosphorus usually form? What is its charge that would be on a phosphorus ion? And you could look at the periodic table and you could say, oh, that's in group 5A, and they form 3 minus charges. And so a phosphorus would be an ion that has 3 negative charges. I could ask you about a calcium, and you could tell me, oh, calcium's in group 2A. They lose 2 charges, and they become 2+ cations. Or potassium becomes a +1. Bromide, a -1. Selenide, a -2. Arsenide, a -3. You could just read the periodic table and know exactly what charge an ion is going to make based on its position in the periodic table. And we haven't dealt with these yet. These become more complicated. And we'll deal with these, I think, in the next lecture. But we're getting there. What's that?
Does that crossed out line count anymore?
The crossed out line is going to create ions. But really, when they get down to this point, that when they get down into the metals away from the nonmetals. So when I get down into tin and I get down into lead, those two, tin and lead, are going to form cations of different types. But silicon, silicon still forms a cation. It can be a +4. I guess germanium can form a cation as well. Carbon doesn't tend to form ions as much as it tends to share. And silicon, I don't really think of silicon as forming an ion as much either. Silicon also tends to share in the same way that carbon does. And if you recall this morning, for those people that were in lab this morning, I talked about these being chemically similar because they have similar electronic configurations. Everything that is in group 1A, all of these guys have their last electron in an S orbital. All of these have their last electron that is an S2. All of these are a P1, a P2, a P3, P4. Just looking at their last electron and where their last electron is for all of those different elements. And that puts them into families that makes them chemically similar. Their chemical similarity comes about from their similar electronic configuration. So lithium will react very similar to sodium. Sodium will react very similar to potassium. Magnesium is very similar to calcium and strontium. And boron and aluminum are very, very similar. Carbon and silicon are very, very similar. So when you hear, and you may have heard some of the sci-fi things about other planets having silicon-based life forms. You ever hear that, silicon-based life forms? And why we might think, oh, why might there be silicon-based life forms? Because carbon and silicon are so similar that it's thought that silicon can form many of the similar types of compounds that carbon is, and that we can have life forms that are based on silicon as opposed to carbon. It's that nature of elements to be chemically similar. Nitrogen and phosphorus are very similar. Phosphorus and arsenic, which is why arsenic forms so many different poisons, is because our body can uptake arsenic and put it in the places that we use phosphorus. Our bodies can uptake strontium and incorporate it into our bones in the same way that we do with calcium. And so all of these different elements are organized in families of similar electronic configurations and therefore similar chemical reactivity. And we're seeing it right now with the ions, that everything here forms a minus one, everything here a minus two, everything on this side a plus one, everything here plus two. They're organized in families, and those families are going to have similar chemical reactivities. Okay, any evidence of silicon-based life forms? No, not yet. And in fact, probably won't, because silicon actually, when silicon is very similar to carbon, carbon can form huge, huge chains. Carbon chains can be 30, 40, 50, 60 carbons long. And we can make carbon molecules that have hundreds, if not thousands, of carbons that are linked together in one big molecule and form a giant chain. You can think of things like graphene or carbon nanotubes and that may have hundreds of carbons in them all strung together. And the carbon-carbon bond is an incredibly stable bond. Silicon, by the time you get about eight silicons in a chain, the chain becomes too unstable and the chain starts to break apart. So at temperatures around 25 degrees Celsius, we don't find very many stable silicon molecules of any length because they break apart too readily. So the silicon is unlikely to do the same sort of job as carbon in that regard. It's just not going to form the complexity of structures that actually carbon can. By chain, I actually mean a literal, when we have carbons, carbons can form molecules where the carbons form a chain. And there are other things connected to them, like hydrogens. But carbon can form this and be 30 to 40 carbons long. And that chain can be linear, or that chain can be branched. And so this can keep going 30 to 40 carbons or more. But silicon, by the time silicon tries to form this chain, silicon becomes unstable by the time it gets to about eight, and the chain fragments and breaks, leaving smaller molecules. And so silicon can't form the complexity that carbon can. Also, carbon, when we look at it, these carbon-hydrogen bonds are very, very stable. And these are the molecules of life, carbon and hydrogen and oxygen. Silicon, when silicon makes these hydrogen bonds, and you expose this to air, even just a small amount of air, silicon-hydrogen bond explodes. It breaks apart and produces a tremendous amount of energy that goes up in a fireball. And so you couldn't have a silicon life form in an oxygen environment because the oxygen environment would kill it. It would have to operate on some other completely different mechanism. So both heat and oxygen are detrimental to forming lots and lots of silicon bonds, which is all kind of cool things to think about. But still being chemically similar, they still like to make four bonds and attach to four things. And they form similar sorts of compounds, just not the complexity. That so while elements within these families, the closest thing to carbon is silicon, they still have their differences, similar and yet different. And that is true for all of these. It is true that calcium will be the most similar to magnesium, but it won't be an identical match. And in fact, there are other trends that we need to talk about as well. There are size trends and electronegativity trends in the periodic table, and all these things that we're going to get to. But first, we're going to talk about ions some more and look at how we can take these ions, and the ions form what are called ionic compounds. So ionic compounds. Ions form ionic compounds by coming together in pairs, binary pairs, of cation to anion. When they come together in such a way as to make an equal number of positives and negatives, such that I can add them together to get a net of zero. When I write their formulas, I write them next to each other with no space between, but I don't include the charges. So when they're written as a compound, they have no charges. They do not show the charges. The charges are implied. And the charges are known by their position in the periodic table. So if I want to make a compound between two ions, say I want to make a compound between sodium and oxide, then what I need to do is I need to combine two sodiums to get two positive charges to match the two negative. And the formula would become Na subscript 2O. And that would be its formula, balancing it for charge. Okay. And if I want to take and combine something like bromide and magnesium, then I need to balance the other way. And I need to include two bromides to get two negatives and two positives. And the formula would be written magnesium bromide with a subscript 2. So naming these and writing these, some common rules that we have. Number one, always the cation first, and then the anion second. Multiple numbers of an anion are denoted by subscripts. Charges are not written but implied. The name of these, the way that we name them, is by naming the cation first and the anion second, followed by the IDE ending for the anion. So when we look at anions and we do nomenclature, I'll try to leave that up there because I know people might be still writing. When we look at doing a name, the name for something, we had sodium and chlorine. This is comprised of a sodium cation, so this one is called sodium ion, and the chloride, this C-H-L-O-R-I-D-E, from the chlorine, but we strike that ending and add the I-D-E ending to denote that this is an anion, and when we combine them together, we drop off the sodium ion, we drop off the ion part, and we call it sodium chloride. And that's the name of the compound. And we can go back and forth between the names and the formulas for these just by knowing their position in the periodic table. So for instance, I could ask you to write the formula for, let's do lithium nitride. So I need to know what a lithium is. lithium is Li plus, and nitride comes from nitrogen. And then I need to look at the periodic table. And let me bring this in one more time. So bringing in this periodic table, I need to find sodium, or excuse me, nitrogen, and I need to know what charge nitrogen becomes. Maybe you guys could tell me by its position in the periodic table, what charge that nitrogen becomes. Does it become a minus one, a minus two, a minus three? Remember that everything on this side of the periodic table is an anion. Everything on this side is a cation. So minus three, good. So nitrogen becomes minus three. What about lithium? What charge does lithium have? Here's lithium in the periodic table. What charge does lithium become? Plus one, good. Okay, so we've got minus three and plus one. The one is redundant, so we tend not to write the one, we just write the positive. And because there are three negatives, that means that I'm gonna have to match the three negatives by including three lithiums to get three positives. So that gives me the three positive charges that I'm denoting, and that means that its formula is going to be Li subscript 3 capital N, and that is lithium nitride. Let's try this one. Let's try writing the formula. This will be the last example we do. Write the formula for what I want to do. Let's do magnesium nitride. Okay, so we just did nitrogen. Can I scroll back up for a second? Oh, you want me to go all the way back up here? Okay, so we're doing magnesium nitride. We just did nitride, so we're gonna catch nitride that's got a three minus, but we've gotta catch magnesium, the symbol for magnesium, Mg, and magnesium is here, so what charge does magnesium become? Good, Vanessa. All right, so this becomes a two plus. Notice that these come in numbers that are not very helpful, twos and threes, which means that if I go to a second magnesium to try to catch up, well, now I've got four to my three. Well, that means I need another nitrogen. That means I've got six to my four. Well, I need another magnesium. Now I've got six to six. So this is six positives and six negatives. And the formula becomes Mg subscript three, N subscript two. And that is magnesium nitride. And so I have to keep going until I can balance out the formulas so that I get a net neutral charge.
Just a quick question. So for, I think it was sodium chloride that you had before.
Yes.
That means that when we see that, it's not like they're not neutral.
So that's right. When you see them put together, whenever they're put together in a formula like that, it means that they are not neutral, that they have charges on it, and that the charges are implied. So we don't tend to write it. It would be incorrect of me to go and to write positive and negative above it. It's because as a chemist, I know that when they're written together by the rules by which we structure our formulas, that this is a sodium cation and a chloride anion, that they are cations and anions, and I know their position in the periodic table, and so their charges are known to me, and it is redundant to put them there. It is extra information that clutters the formula, and so we don't write the charges in that way.
Okay.
That's a good question and good clarification. I appreciate that. Okay. This is where I want to cut it. We're going to pick up and do a little bit more with ionic formulas when we come back tomorrow. And then we'll launch into chapter four, which starts looking at sharing of electrons and the covalent compounds and the structures and things that we see there. And so we'll start getting into some three-dimensional geometries and structures of covalent compounds and the sharing of electrons, and how do we look at those different than we look at the ionic compounds. And we have to go through a whole nomenclature thing. So we will have nomenclature tomorrow, some three-dimensional structure tomorrow, but we'll also finish out these ionic compounds. And there's much more to do with the ionic compounds than we realize, because we also have what are called polyatomic ions, many atom ions, and they also form these ionic compounds. And that's where memorization starts to come in. Let me just help one thing before you go and remind you that when we looked at the periodic table, there was elements that I asked you to know on the periodic table that I said were really helpful to be able to know. And it was these guys here. It was everybody that was in this first group here. Helium was good to know. Aluminum, chloride, all of these guys are good. And then I said that there was a few that were in here that were really helpful. And lead and tin and mercury. And I think that's going to do it for now. If you can start getting some of the names of those guys. Oops, I didn't need to hit all the way down to astatine. Get out of there. I want that to go away. Okay. That's my list of elements that I want you to be familiar with, to be able to sort of recognize on sight and know their symbols when I throw them out. And that's going to help you to recognize these compounds and to know the names of these compounds by knowing the names of these elements. Okay? So we had that on a previous discussion. We'll just reinforce it here. So you got a little bit of work to do. I'm going to remind you that the test is up, and then I want you to start working on that. Try and get it done by Tuesday night, by tomorrow night. If not, if you need more time, I completely understand, and it is open-ended, so there is more time available to you. It'll mark it as the submission is late, but it will not take any points off, same way that we've been doing the quizzes. So if you need flexibility, you have it. You don't even need to ask me. But if you fall too far behind, you should reach out to me and let me know that you're behind a bit and that you need some support. So, and if I don't see the grade show up, I might reach out to you and ask you if you need some support. Other than that, I'm about 5 minutes over time, and I suggest that we adjourn for lunch, and then we'll pick it up in the afternoon lab. How's that sound?
I just want one question about, sorry, I think I might have missed this. You were talking about, because like throughout you've been putting like these, like 1s2 or 2s2 or whatever, for like the atom structures and stuff. And I was wondering if you could just briefly just explain how you get that like name for the atom kind of thing.
I think I'm missing the question. Everybody can log off if they want. I'll deal with individual questions. You guys can stick around. Anybody who wants to stick around, I'll answer a few questions.
I think it was at the very beginning. Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Is that Ellis? Are you asking? Is that who's asking?
Yeah.
Okay. At the very beginning, when I was going through...
Wait, no, I think it was a little bit farther than... Because you were like going... Yeah, right there. See, like that, the red, like 1s2, 2s2, 2p6. Like, how do you get that? Because I understand like it comes from like the levels, but I'm just like, I want to make sure I understand exactly how to like...
Okay, so what I'm doing is I am enumerating the number of electrons in each sublevel. So when I see 1s2, it is in the 1s, there are two electrons.
Okay.
In the 2s, there are two electrons. So the superscript is telling me how many electrons in that sublevel. In the 2p, there are 2, 4, 6 electrons in that 2p sublevel. Thus, the superscript is 6.
Okay, I think I understand. So would it be, and then the other part that I wasn't quite understanding, but I think I understand now, is so it's 1s, 2s, 2p, 3s, 3p, and then it would be one more, like 3d. There's, I don't remember the exact next one, but that would be like...
Yes, and then there's a filling order, and that's what I was going through in a little more detail in the lab. So, Ellis, are you picking it up in the afternoon lab?
I'm not taking the lab.
You're not taking lab. Okay, so you're going to need some extra support, and I will have to... I'm going to have to give you guys in lecture a little bit more then, because there's a good group of people that are not in the lab, and I keep forgetting that.
This makes sense, though. I think
The difference is that as I was filling out the periodic table, the filling order can be gleaned from the periodic table. So we're out here, these are 2s1, 2s2, then I go to 2p1, 2p2, 2p3, 2p4, 2p5, 2p6, start back over at 3s1, 3s2, and the filling order is denoted. It just changes when I get here. So this is 4s1, 4s2, and then it falls down to 3d1, 3d2, 3d, because the first energy level to have d's is 3.
Yeah.
And so I go across the 3d's, and then I go back, after I fill the 3d's, I go back to the 4p's.
Oh, what? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So basically, it's like each time you kind of repeat like what you were doing before. So it would be like, you go 1s, which is the first energy level, and then there's 2s, 2,
or and then 2p.
2s, 2p, which is the second, and then there's 3s, 3p, 3d, which is the third, 4s, 4p, 4d, 4s.
Yes, but what's happening is the 3d's don't fill until after the 4s's. What happens with those is that when I look at the principal energy levels, the principal energy levels start to collapse. So when I look at principal energy levels, it looks like this. 1, 2 is much higher than 1. 3 is a little bit closer to 2. 4 is a little bit closer to 3. 5, 6, 7, they stack in on top of each other. In principal energy level 1, there is one sublevel. It is the 1s. In principal energy level 2, there are two sublevels, the 2s and the 2p. In principal energy level 3, there are three sublevels. There is the 3s, the 3p, and then I've got the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the 3ds. In principal energy level 4, I have the 4s, and then I have the 4ps, and then I have the 4ds. But what happens is the energy levels are starting to collapse. And so literally what happens is if I take these guys and highlight them and style them red, and these guys and style them, stop, decline, go away. Hang on a second, I lost my spring screen broadcasting. Okay, I think I'm back up, right? Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Okay. Style in blue. 3. Style in green. And then let's take 4 and style this sort of in a purple color. So we're getting the different energy levels. When I fill these energy levels, I go from the 1s to the 2s. From the 2s, I go to the 2p. From the 2p, I go to the 3s. 3s, I go to the 3ps. From the 3ps, I go to the 4s, and then to the 3ds, and then to the 4ps. That I fill them in order of their energy. And because they are collapsing, because these energy levels are getting closer and closer together, I get this mixing up in the upper orbitals. And so the 3ds are higher in energy than the 4s's. And so I fill, I go 1s, 2s, 2p, 3s, 3p, 4s, then 3d, then 4p, and they go in this odd order. The order can be remembered by constructing a table, 1s, 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s, 6, and 7. First one to have p's is 2. I always have trouble with this table. It's really not hard to do, but my brain hates it. But it's very useful. 3s are the first one to have d's. 4s are the first one to have f's. 5s are the first to have G's. And that's as far as you need to go. You don't even need to go out that far. To reproduce the filling order, you strike a diagonal arrow starting from the top and working your way down, and we start writing 1S. Second arrow, 2S. Third arrow, 2P, 3S. Fourth arrow, 3P, 4S. Fifth arrow, 3D, 4P, 5S. This is the filling order.
Oh.
That filling order tells me that I fill the 1S's, then the 2S's, then the 2P's, then the 3S's, and the 3P's, then the 4S's before the 3D's. It accurately predicts that I fill the 4S's before the 3D's, something that I would have had to either understand or read from the periodic table that this here is the 3D's. So while I fill the 4S's, I go into the 3D's, then back to the 4P's, and that's what this trend here, 4S, then 3D's, then back to the 4P's, that's what this trend is telling me.
Okay. I'm copying this down. It's like really helpful.
That's cool.
Okay. This makes sense then. So it's like, okay, I think there's sense. You just fill it up that way, even though it's not in that order, kind of.
That's right. It's important to fill it that in that order. And the book goes through this very clearly as well. So if you read through the textbook is good support for this as well in terms of the filling order.
Okay, awesome.
And I believe this little memory tool is also in the textbook.
Cool. All right. Awesome. Well, that answers my question then. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking that. Okay. Does anybody else have any other questions they'd like me to address before we take a break for lunch? Okay. If not, I suggest we adjourn. We'll take a 20-minute break, 25 minutes, and then we'll come back. And we'll do some afternoon lab. All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.